Okay, well, we are having our participants are making their way virtually to our forums. So we will start here momentarily. Maybe while participants are coming in, let me just introduce you a little to the series, because this is a new series for Hoover. The series is called 10 Years In, and it's a decade of US cyber strategy. So over the next 6 to 8 weeks, we are going to be featuring some of the best thought minds in cyber strategy from both the academic and the think tank communities, as well as the defense leaders who have had a hand in drafting these strategies. Now, many of these participants you'll find are authors on a co-edited volume that I worked on called 10 Years In. And there should be a link to 10 Years In where you registered. So if you're interested, and the good thing is it is a government publication, so it is free to download. And so you can peruse at your heart's content. I want to welcome you all here today. This series is about cyber strategy. And the book, 10 Years In, looks at how we're actually implementing cyber strategy. It's a co-edited volume. So I started this with Dr. Michael Warner and Dr. Emily Goldman at US Cyber Command. And I came to them a few years ago and I said, oh, let's get all the best minds about cyber strategy and let's debate cyber strategy. And Dr. Goldman said, no, even better. Let's talk about how we actually make strategy work. So each one of the chapters is devoted to different elements of cyber strategy. And it tries to outlay kind of the challenges about implementing cyber strategy, and hopefully take us on kind of a first road to thinking about how we might think about future success. So today is our kickoff. And I am really, really excited to have with us two extraordinary cyber thinkers, Andy Grotto and Jay Healy. Andy is is one of my Stanford colleagues here, and he's the director of the program on geopolitics, technology, and governance. He's also the William Perry International Security Fellow at the Stanford Cyber Policy Center and a visiting fellow here at Hoover Institution. Now, before coming to Stanford, Andy was the senior director for cybersecurity policy at the White House, and his tenure spanned actually both the Obama administration and part of the Trump administration. So he has a first eye view into the development of strategy at the highest levels. Our other guest today is Jay Healy, who is a senior research scholar at Columbia University's CEPA School. He is also the author of a book that I highly recommend called Fierce Domain, which looks at the development of cyber defense, cyber in the United States from 1986 to 2012. So, you know, as we get into it, the first thing I want to kind of talk about really quickly is like, why do we have strategies? What is the point of strategies? I will say, as an academic, we often look at strategies as this kind of grand narrative of what states are going to do or how they're going to signal other states. But I think the reality of strategy for anybody who's actually written strategy or tried to implement strategy is that it's a messy process. It's a messy process with a lot of pens. And back in the old days, and in today's day, it is a Microsoft Word document full of revisions, lot of track changes. And so every single word that is included in a cyber strategy has been, you know, negotiated and revised. And so these words really matter. So kind of what's the point of this cyber strategy and defense cyber strategy? I would say two things. One is signaling. So we're signaling our adversaries what we intend to do in cyberspace and what our capabilities are. And so inherent in that signaling is also assumptions that we're making about how we can both deter and coerce our adversaries into not taking certain actions in cyberspace. And then the second, and this is where we'll spend a little bit of time as well, is strategy is also a conversation to the organizations underneath. So the DoD is not just Cyber Command. Cyber Command is actually one very small element of DoD cyberspace. And there's the Defense Information Security Agency, DISA. There are all of the service cyber elements. So it's a vast and disparate organization. And so that cyber strategy is supposed to tell all these vast organizations what they should be doing, where they should be prioritizing, and how they should be implementing their resources, their manpower, and their organization in order to achieve strategic objectives. So it needs to be able to communicate clearly on both ends. And we'll talk about whether the strategies that have occurred over the last 10 years have done a good job of that. So that said, I want to leave off with a really kind of big question for you, Jay. Your book looks at a very long time period from 1986 to 2012. Most of that time period is actually before most kind of strategic approaches to cyberspace, at least in kind of a formal way. So I just kind of wanted to get your thoughts a little bit on, was there a strategic vision in those 20 years? How did you see it evolve? And then kind of what's the relationship between where you leave off in 2012 and where cyber strategy picks up for the next 10 years that we're discussing today?
Thanks a lot. And, you know, a lot of it comes down to, I actually disagreed with your first sentence about it's how the strategy is about signaling. That's true about a national security strategy, but it need not be true about a cybersecurity strategy. And so as you go through this entire series, be thinking about, or when we say strategy, what is the scope of the strategy that you're that you want to look at? One of the big differences between me and others is that I tend to strategize about how do we improve cybersecurity as a whole for the entire internet, under the assumption that American interests will then ride on having that, including national security interests, we'll then be able to hook ourselves to that trailer of a broadly secure internet and go through. I tend to think about whole of system. That doesn't mean I'm any more right or correct, or it's a more privileged view than those that say, all right, let's do a whole of nation approach, for example, and saying, you know what, let's prioritize American interests in cyberspace, and then hope that that doesn't cause too much impact on the other values that we want to prioritize for the internet as a whole, such as open, resilient, and secure. So when in this entire series, the people that are joining this, when you hear Shai, just think about how the tension between those two. Think about where you come down on each of those and why, and how that might change over time. So to get to how you let in on this, Jackie, you know, we certainly, when we're looking back in the earlier days from 86 on, or even pre-86, right, there wasn't any particular strategy. You had these little bits that were looking at computer security. You were looking at having little bits that were looking at computer crime. You had some bits that were looking at counterintelligence and intelligence operations over computer, but they hadn't really been coming together. And there certainly wasn't a sense of you didn't need a military strategy because you couldn't affect much military change or be affected too much. It really, I would say, 1998 was the year that you really saw that change. And I would say 97 to into 1998. Actually, let me go just really quickly before that. In his chapter, Michael Warner at Cyber Command talks about this document. It was called Cornerstones of Information Warfare that came out from the United States Air Force, signed out by both the Secretary and the Chief of Staff of the Air Force. So an important document. And remember what I said, right? In 1986, you didn't need a military strategy because there wasn't any there when it came to the military, right? It's like you didn't need a military strategy for air power in 1905. But boy, by 1918, if you didn't, you were really behind. And what the Cornerstones document said that was prior to the Wright brothers air existed, but you couldn't have widespread military operations in it until the invention of the airplane. They said, likewise, there was an information realm prior to networked computers, but it took the development of networked computers so that you could imagine military significant maneuvering and goals within this information realm, right? It's a great statement. It's back in 1995. So 1997, there's a presidential commission on critical infrastructure protection, very, very influential, maybe even more influential than Solarium. Actually, I would say it was probably more influential than Solarium. That directly led to a presidential decision directive 63 on critical infrastructure protection. That was 97, early 1998, the military suffers a significant incident where that could have been significant. We thought it was significant, called Solar Sunrise. Turns out it was two kids in their basement in California, Machiavelli and Stimpy, with an Israeli mentor. But we thought, so I was in the Air Force at this time, most of my colleagues went through this, that it was Saddam Hussein for reasons we can get into. And this led to a situation where in the tank, you had in the Pentagon, you had the Deputy Secretary of Defense say, okay, who's in charge here? And all around the room, right? Nobody was stepping up to say, we're in charge here. And I swear I had a one star that was one star at the time. He was in, because he was in the back seats, right? He's only one star. Kick the chair of the two star in front of him. And that two star then says, well, I guess I am Mr. Secretary. Right, so a lot happened in that 1998 timeframe where now you had military organizations, right? I helped set up that first Cyber Command, Joint Task Force Computer Network Defense, that stood up in the end of 1998. You then had saying, all right, we need strategies that are capturing this point. So before that, you had individual strategies, mostly about computer security. But I would say from that 1998 timeframe, you now had the military that was strategizing a bit more, especially about cyber.
I want to pick up on an argument that Jay made right at the beginning of that conversation, and something that you kind of you see historically. So, like, what does Jay point to as one of the most historic moments for strategy? It's not a DoD strategy, and in fact, it's not anything to do with warfighting at all. It has to do with critical infrastructure. Now, Andy, you had a perspective. Really kind of from the top, from the executive level. And I kind of am interested in hearing where you think defense strategy fits among other cyber strategies and then other larger national security strategies, and where you see this moving, you know, defense cyber strategy always had the same relationship with these larger strategies? Especially, I think there's a really clear comparison between 2015 and 2018.
Yeah, great question, Jackie, and congratulations to you and your co-editors and authors for a really terrific volume. I learned a lot from reading it, and I highly recommend it to anybody who's listening who wants to, you know, get a bird's eye view on DoD cyber strategy. One of the arguments that comes out in the book, and I think this was in Dr. Golden's chapter, and it's certainly implied in General Nakasone's introduction, which, by the way, I should be required reading from here on out, because it's really, there were parts of it that I wanted to pull my hair out about, to be frank, other parts that I thought were brilliant. And it's a really rich piece in just seven pages. One of the arguments that Dr. Goldman makes is that, you know, that there's this paradigm shift potentially underway, that, you know, until persistent engagement, the paradigm in cyber strategy was, you know, call it being reactive, call it resilience, call it some combination of those things. And I would argue that actually that's not quite right, that we are still in the same paradigm that we have been in ever since the late 1990s, which is what I would call laissez-faire, And, you know, at its core, you know, it essentially says that the market will supply sufficient incentive for the private sector, which owns the vast majority of critical infrastructure, to defend their networks commensurate with the public interest. And I think it's impossible to examine whether that's a DoD cyber command strategy, whether that's you know, DHS's role in resilience without, I think, that paradigm in the background. I do think that what we may be seeing today, and it kind of gets caught up in this broader tech clash we're seeing, you know, beyond you know, this more narrow lane of cyber policy, is this idea that, you know, maybe the, you know, maybe all this technology innovation has entailed some cost, and maybe it hasn't quite gone the way we would like it to in terms of producing safe and secure products. And so, you know, just to come back to Jay's point about, you know, this whole kind of whole of nation idea of strategy, that's where I think DoD is really kind of, one way DoD has struggled to kind of articulate a vision that kind of matches kind of where the country is today with respect to this paradigm and its perception of, you know, the adversary's intentions, capabilities, and our own vulnerabilities. You know, I my first reaction to the concept of persistent engagement was moral hazard. And, you know, and so I worked in the Hill in the US Senate before I worked at the White House. I was a professional staff member on the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, where I was, I had the cyber portfolio for the committee. This was about 10 years ago, as well as the oversight portfolio for the National Security Agency. And I was involved, I was the lead drafter of what ultimately became the Cybersecurity Information Sharing Act, its precursor in, you know, 2012, 2013. And, you know, I'll never forget the, you know, critical infrastructure sectors would come in and argue that, look, like what we need the government just to tell us what to do in terms of giving us classified information about what our adversaries are doing. We need the government to go out and disrupt, you know, all of these nation state actors because, you know, you don't expect us to defend against ballistic missile strikes. Why, you know, why is it reasonable to expect us to defend against a nation state level cyber attack? And the answer I always gave was, look, like, you know, you have responsibilities too. And, you know, there is this question I still think we have an answer to as a country. I think it's rooted in this laissez-faire paradigm we find ourselves in still. Where does the line between a private organization's, particularly in critical infrastructure, where does their responsibility end and the government's begin? And we simply haven't answered that question yet. And to me, that is, in many ways, perhaps the sort of the signature challenge for cyber strategy now looking out ahead over the next 5 to 10 years.
So I want to push you guys a little bit about, like, what the role of the DoD should be, because I think the DoD cyber strategy articulates, like, what the DoD, and it's, you know, approved by the executive, but what the DoD thinks its strategy, what it thinks its role should be in these larger strategies. So interesting difference between the 2015 strategy and the 2018 strategy. So I would characterize cyber strategies having the DoD strategies, there's three kind of main strategies. One's not a DoD strategy. One is the international, the 2011 Obama administration international strategy for cyberspace, which actually spends most of its time dedicated to outlining what it thinks its strategic priorities are. I think it's actually the clearest and most articulate strategy for priorities. So they spend a lot of time there, and then they spend most of the time in that strategy talking about the role of the Department of Homeland Security, the role of FBI, the role of norms and diplomacy. And then the DoD is a bit of an asterisk. It's like, oh, y'all deter on the edges, you know? And I think that 2011 strategy really represents the initial focus of the Obama administration, which was they had to build lines in the road. There were, like, nobody knew who was supposed to do what. It was a bit of a pie fight. Usually DOD wins in pie fights because they're the biggest, but the Obama administration really like put a premium on DOD not winning this pie fight. And for anyone who was working in the DC area at that time, there was this like infamous bubble chart. And it was a PowerPoint chart that really awful. Like federal government doesn't pay for like good graphics. So it was, you know, like somebody built three bubbles, and inside these bubbles were these tiny, tiny little words. And all of those tiny little words were what each of these agencies was supposed to do. And it was funny because I don't think the Obama administration ever codified this PowerPoint presentation into an actual like order or directive or nothing codified, but it was, everyone said, oh no, DOD doesn't do that. Look at the bubble chart. You know, so for years, like that's what the bubble chart was. And so the bubble chart comes up into 2015. And this is when the Obama administration writes its first or directs its first real defense cyber strategy. And that defense cyber strategy follows very clearly those lines in the road. And it says, DOD, your role is to be prepared and to deter. And there's a lot of focus on kind of building up National Guard resources to respond to crises and thinking a lot about cross-domain deterrence. I mean, back in those days, Cyber Command is still a sub-unified command under Strategic Command. So you have this like legacy of nuclear deterrence that is, you know, kind of dominating strategic discussion at cyberspace. And then this strategy comes out, and then Sony happens, and there's all this cyber stuff happening, and DOD's like, oh, put me in. You know, like there's all these attacks that are happening against critical infrastructure, and DOD is just like sitting on the sides, and they're like, put me in, coach. I can do a great job, right? But then they're not really like prepared to do this great job because they don't have a clear narrative about what their job is besides deterrence. So then you move into 2018. And here's where you actually get a bit of tension between Cyber Command, I think, and the kind of OSD DOD. So for those of you who are listening who don't know, the way strategy is supposed to work is Andy at the White House writes a national strategy. National cyberspace strategy, national security strategy. They think about it. They think about how all the agencies work together. They write it. Then that goes to the DOD, and the DOD says, I know what my lane is. I know what my strategic priorities are. Let me write my strategy, and it will clearly define what everyone underneath me is supposed to do. And then it goes to Cyber Command, and Cyber Command says, I will implement your strategy, DOD. And maybe me as a commander, I have a vision, and I will write my vision. Y'all, that is not what happened in 2018. In 2018, Cyber Command writes a vision, which is called a vision, but everyone calls a strategy. So there are clear doctrinal reasons why that is not a strategy, but they call it a vision. That's persistent engagement. Then the OSD strategy comes out, and OSD introduces a whole different concept called defend forward. Hence 3 years of confusion about whether defend forward or persistent engagement is like the true kind of strategic line of effort. And then the NSC comes out with a strategy not connected to any of the other two strategies at all, right? So this is kind of what happens in 2018. So all that preliminary to lead into, I want to ask Jay and Andy, okay, we're moving into the Obama administration. I think there's still a lot of debate about like who is leading this kind of strategic priorities. Which concepts do we keep? Do we keep persistent engagement? Do we keep defend forward? Is deterrence back in a big way? So who should be in the lead here? And what do you think should be the priorities for the DOD lines of efforts within these strategies? I'll go ahead and start with Jay.
Okay. Sometimes I'm a former policymaker and I speak in a particular way when I come wearing my former White House. Sometimes I speak in a specific way when I'm a former think tanker and I speak with emphasis, and I'm probably exaggerating and using hyperbole. Sometimes I'm speaking as an academic and I want to be really precise with my words. For this one, I'll be think tank and I'll speak with some hyperbole. The Department of Defense and the intelligence community have done far more damage in cybersecurity writ large for the internet as a whole than they have ever done for to actually help secure it, right? In this, like, the military is not a global force for good. We have blundered and made as many mistakes as we have helped. Again, do I actually mean that? I don't really know. But right, so we've got to change our mindset in this. We're used to saying, here's a national security problem. Good, where's the military? They need to come in. And what we haven't done is say, all right, here's the wide range of problems that we need to get solved. Like, here's the ball field, right? We've got 9 players on the ball field. Who's closest to be able to make the play wherever that ball is hit? And most of the time, it's the private sector that happens to be closest to the ball and able to make the play. Yes, maybe they don't have a good glove, or they don't have any glove, and the government can help them get a glove. Maybe they can't see the ball clearly, and we need to help them in sharing intelligence so they can see the ball. Maybe they don't even. Maybe they need to practice their skills, and the government has a role in that. Maybe like if they were like me in Little League, that maybe they've forgotten there's even a ball game on, right? Until they hear the crack of the bat and they see it's coming towards them. Right. And so if we think, what's that larger set of things that need to get done, then we can say, all right, what unique things does the government bring and what uniquely does the military bring? Right. Most of the levers and buttons within the military don't actually fix cybersecurity problems. Right. The military is really good at spying and shooting back. Right. If your solution doesn't include spying or shooting back, right, the military, I'll add hunting forward in there, right? I mean, again, I'm speaking a little bit of hyperbole there, right? But most of the time, right, if you can just get AT&T or Verizon or Microsoft to make the switch, like, you're in a lot better shape than you know, Cyber Command NSA can't do the things at scale that Google can, that Microsoft's can, that things you can do in the Cyber Threat Alliance. So please, as you're thinking about your strategy, thinking, what is that unique bit that national security is really going to bring to this? It's not necessarily intelligence, right? It's a subset of intelligence. It's disruption. So please keep in your mind as we're thinking through that. For me personally, I start everything with get defense better than offense, right? That's where I start. It hasn't been a level playing field. The attackers have had most of the advantages since the 70s. We need to change that. I mostly build my solutions around the private sector. And then I say, all right, where is the military going to fit in on that? One last point. Think about other successful military strategies, right? What was our Cold War strategy? One word, containment. If you were a staff sergeant working for General Petraeus and you were walking to a tribal village, you knew his expectations because the strategy was so simple for victory. Essentially win hearts and minds, right? You knew as a staff sergeant what was expected for you going into that village and in every village during your tour. Another general that would say, no, it's not win hearts and minds, it's stab the bad guys. Seek out and stab the bad guys, right? A simple strategy. I would argue that none of our strategies, and I include persistent engagement, have actually been strategies. They've been a list of actions that you cannot summarize in any point shorter than the actual table of contents, right? The strategies that Jackie led off with were like 5 pillars. I say, if you need 5 pillars in your strategy, it's not a strategy. And so we need to start coming in. What's our actual strategy? I say, get defense better than offense. Maybe you disagree. And if so, like, a good strategy should be negatable. No, Healy's wrong. It should be this. Short set of words. And then I think we can have a real debate about what the strategy ought to be. Thank you.
So let me take a stab at this one word strategy, Jay. Resilience. You know, and so, you know, to come back to Jackie's introductory points about what is strategy, you know, just to, you know, add to her summary, I think the strategy is having an end state with means articulated to reach that end state, right? And you call it a deliberative framework for managing disputes along the way, right? When equities clash. To me, resilience kind of, you know, provides us a North Star where we can then ask, okay, if our strategy is resilience, what role should DoD play in that, right? Persistent engagement may well be the right part of the right answer, right? But there may be other elements, right? So, the Department of Defense has this initiative underway focused on its supply chain. CMMC is the inevitable acronym. It's the Cybersecurity Maturity Model Certification. Controversial, not particularly well loved, but the idea is that in the coming years, the DIB, which is hundreds of thousands of companies of all shapes and sizes, are going to have to essentially meet certain minimum cybersecurity requirements, and in some cases, have an outside auditor come in and certify compliance. That's I would say, an important part of DoD's cyber strategy, not just for the resilience of DoD's own supply chain, its own enterprise risk posture, but given that there is this broader debate happening at a national, global level even, on how do we measure trust in IT, whether that's at the product level or at the enterprise level, that initiative, the CMMC, has potentially strategic implications, right, as part of a resilience strategy. And so, you know, from my perspective, I would like us to see, and I think this is consistent with Jay and Jackie have both said, implicitly or explicitly, is that we have to think about the Department of Defense strategy as a component of a national strategy, not as sort of like, you know, the pointy end of the strategy spear. You know, the inversion of the process that Jackie laid out, from the vision to the DoD strategy to, you know, the NSC strategy, that there's a whole story behind that someone I'm sure will tell at some point. Much of it has to do, I think, with the challenges that the team at the White House faced in coordinating an initiative of that scale with a president that, whenever he heard the word cyber, would immediately go to Russia hoax, and developing a strategy without of that scale, that magnitude, without presidential leadership is simply impossible.
If I can just add on that, like I think that's a great point, right? And to me, it is the presidential security. I mean, the presidential decision to me, the one that we need the president to make. Like, what's like? Are we going to be more offense? Or are we going to be more like? Are we going to prioritize defense and only do offense on the edges? Even if that hurts us in other areas, like it means we're going to have to pull back a little bit on cyber covert action and espionage, or are we going to say, you know what, America's in a dangerous place, and we need to prioritize keeping ourselves safe from the traditional enemies, even if it means it's not going to be an open, secure, resilient internet with the knock-on effects on economy and society, right? To me, that is the presidential decision that we need the person behind the Resolute desk to make. Once we get that decision, we can go off and do what we need, right? For President Obama, in most cases, it's a balance. Now, what do you do if you're a major and the order comes down from the colonel that, all right, I want you to balance offense and defense while you're holding your position? Well, what the hell does that mean, right? It means every decision is bespoke. Every decision needs a committee to figure out how this is balancing. And so again, maybe that's the way that I framed that big decision for the president. Other strategists that you're going to hear through this series are going to frame it up differently. But let's make sure that we get that up and to frame it simply in a way that the boss can make a decision that we can then make strategies about, of how to implement that vision that the president.
It's funny. I think Jay and I have, like, very at its core, very different opinions about the purpose of strategy, because I hate strategy as a motto. Hate it. Like
persistent. You're here.
One of the things I did on the Solarium Commission was we had to kind of reconcile defend forward and persistent engagement. And there was a lot of, like I'm gonna show my cards here. There's a lot of infighting about like, are we focused on defend forward or are we focused on persistent engagement?
How many angels can dance in the head of a pin?
Yeah. So what it came down to me was, look, strategy is kind of like what Andy was saying, you know, it's the priorities. It's open, secure internet. It's I'm going to safeguard true information. Like that's strategic priorities. And then my strategy of how I'm going to get to those strategic priorities is about balancing all these other lines of effort and what lines of effort I'm going to devote, you know, for each agency or how much effort I'm going to put into each of these lines of effort. And so for me, persistent engagement doesn't provide any of that, right? So I'm looking at it from two sides. One is as like, I'm an academic, I love strategy. And then like, I was a reservist that had to implement strategies. And if anybody's been a staff officer and you get the little, oh, you're on LOE, whatever, make that LOE happen. You're like, well, excuse my language. Well, shit, it would have been nice if they used clearer words so I had some idea of what they were trying to get at. Yeah. Oh, persistent engagement, just okay, I'm going to do everything all the time. That's not implementable, right? But I think that's actually why we saw a lot of operational innovation that occurred mm-hmm. in the last 4 years, because I think of persistent engagement like just do it, you know, like you're not waiting for it to happen, you're doing it. And that's like a really motivating cry. And it actually changes, like for the DoD, it changes a mind frame from campaign plans, which is a very kind of codified planning process, to task forces, which is a more living kind of planning process. And so I see there are a lot of operational innovation occurred there. But like my argument would be what happened over the last 4 years is that like, we're still playing a game of whack-a-mole. We're just playing a better game of whack-a-mole. And without like that strategic focus yeah. and like priorities about lines of effort, yeah. we're gonna continue playing whack-a-mole. So awesome. I wanna get to some of the really good questions that have started popping up, because I think some of these questions actually have to do with the debate about the strategies themselves. And these are important because if anybody on here is listening from the Biden transition team, you guys have some really important decisions to make in the next 6 months to a year. And these are some smart minds. So I want to bring these to you guys' attention and get your thoughts. So one question is, and this is also, I think, something that we all might disagree on, is when do cyber attacks merit a kinetic response?
Yeah, so I always come back to this is not a satisfying answer. And it is one that I think in particular, like is why the Cyberspace Solarium Commission came into being. But it basically boils down to sort of Potter Stewart's, you know, saying about, you know, indecency, right? You know it when you see it. So, you know, the short answer is I don't think there's a clear, it's easy to imagine cases where, you know, we would definitely say yes. I mean, that, you know, an attack on infrastructure that results in like casualties, right? Like, that is different than espionage or even operational preparation of the environment. And you know, it's always going to be a context dependent judgment. You know, red lines are a tool. They're not an end state, right? You know, we articulate red lines as a means to some policy end, and you know, without having clarity about what that policy end is, and what tools you have at your disposal to achieve that end, having red lines may or may not make sense.
Yeah, really, really well said. A couple of things. One, let me just write down the third of them. Okay. First, keep in mind when we talk about this question, it works both ways, right? Your answer that you come up with what should be for us, think about how that's going to apply for our adversaries, right? I hear too often, well, what if X adversary that just did Sony, you know, they just blew up this place. Imagine if they would have done that with Domini, that would be war, and therefore Sony might be war. Yeah, think about Iran and covert action and Stuxnet when we do that, right? We've thrown punches. And so, again, I'm not making any kind of moral equivalence in what we've done and what others have done. I'm saying when we're talking about the dynamics and where the red lines should be, think about, and it doesn't even need to be universal, but a lot of folks thought that we did after Snowden was unacceptable and had crossed their red lines. Certainly Iran did, had crossed their red lines. We didn't suffer any particular blowback from those. And so do keep in mind about where our answer is going to be and where the answers of adversaries are going to be. Two, I like to flip it around. Imagine that some state escalates to kinetic force in response to something cyber. Imagine NATO just declared an Article 5 for NATO. Walk backwards. Like, this is something fun to do with my, you know, with my students. Well, maybe not fun, but tell me what just happened. Give me a narrative about that cyber incident that caused that state to go kinetic, right? And you can get a pretty good sense of what that answer is going to be. Right? I mean, a large number of casualties, right? They brought a banking system down for a long period of time. They caused some incident that has a significant and lasting impact on GDP. And that can help at least build you out. At the end of the day, it's always going to be what's up to the decision maker, right? It's going to be up in the US context to that president that's saying, this much is too much. So the best that we can do is try and come up with some of these hazy places, because it's going to depend on that decision maker, how they're feeling that day, who the adversary was, right? I mean, if this is something accidental from Russia, would have been taken very differently under say Bolton than something incidental but smaller from Iran. And that's okay. We just have to keep those in mind. Last, and I wish this had been published, but it never was. 10 years ago, the U.S. Cyber Consequences Unit, run by a guy named Scott Borg, John Bumgarner, did some work which they said was founded on actual data. But they did this wonderful curve that said, imagine a cyber attack of X duration, and that's the X-axis, that takes out Y, which is the percent of GDP that's disrupted. So they did this for electricity, but also oil and gas. So imagine that the United States electrical grids are out, or some significant portion of the US electrical grid, in a way that they're not able to get in significant outside help to the grid. They said over the period of about day zero to say day 7 to 10, the curve is relatively flat or low because you're substituting. Right, you know, you've got diesel to the generators, like you're going to the back of your larder to find the beans, like you're lighting candles and using batteries. It's cold, so you snuggle up harder with your dog or your loved one. After that period, about 7 to 10 days, huge knee in the curve, because now you can't substitute anymore. You're out of diesel. Your spouse can't handle your neediness, right? You can't get the generators to start anymore until like around day 21. It just flattens out at like 90% of GDP, because the system just locks up. Like, you just can't get diesel to where it needs to be anymore. You just can't, you know, nothing can happen. Whether or not that is exactly the right numbers doesn't matter. The shape of that curve is important to answering this question by Harrison, right? If you're in that day 1 to 3, kinetic response wouldn't make a lot of sense there. Citizens of the world are going to say, like, you're attacking back on that. But clearly day 12 is too late, because your economy is already starting to lock up. So you want to do it when it's early enough that you can get the other person to stop and punish them, but not so late that you've let it go and your self-help won't make any difference.
Okay, I want to go back. I got a question via email that's even that is even more applied. And the question is, how has the strategy over the last 3 years, how effective has it been against North Korea?
I think the short answer is we don't know. In part because I think, well, let me, it depends what you mean by effective, right? If, you know, by effective, you know, you mean a North Korea that, you know, is denuclearized, obviously not. A new North Korea that has made substantial progress in its missile and nuclear programs, no. If the question, if by effective we mean, you know, would they have made more progress, but for, you know, possible cyber actions? Maybe, but I don't think we know. So, you know, it's but it all comes down to like what we mean by effective. What are the success metrics? Which, frankly, is a problem that affects cyber strategy. You know, more broadly, right? Is, you know, how would we, you know, measure the success of a cyber strategy? You know, in the Cold War, right? Like, one measure of success was, you know, the United States and the Soviet Union didn't annihilate each other, right? That's one measure. But, you know, there are other ways to look at that. And I think it's even harder here because, you know, just the indicators of success or failure are noisier, and in many cases either classified or proprietary in the hands of individual private companies who, you know, do or don't suffer incidents.
I'm a bit, you know, I had some tough moments on this because I was able to talk to some very, very, very senior military people. And I said, you know, I raised the measurement issue. And I mean, it took us 10 minutes before someone actually said, yeah, he's got a point. You know, maybe we should measure this. The measurement that's going to be, that the military is going to be strongest about are the military's of the measures of effectiveness. Like, we shot, they kept their head down. The equivalent of body bag counts. I mean, to be perfectly honest, right? We wanted to have some effect. You know, it seems like our suppressing fire worked. But the promises that have been made implicitly and explicitly of defend, forward, and persistent engagement is not just that suppressing fire is going to suppress. It's that over time, this is going to lead to better national security results. Right? If not promising that, then it's not really a strategy, it's an operating concept. And I agree with Jackie. I don't think it is a strategy. I think it is. And I don't mean to take anything away from it as the most brilliant piece of work that we've come out with, or a brilliant piece of work and a fabulous operating concept. But so let's just take that the implicit and explicitly, it's saying that it's gonna lead to better national security over time as adversaries through friction, through our improved defense, through indications and warning and other mechanisms are gonna get them to back down, tacit bargaining. I would say the persistent engagers, those that are most hawkish about this, go further. They say this imposing costs in this manner is the most significant thing that we have ever done. Right? You can get that from Nakasone's introduction, you know, great introduction, that right, the reason it hasn't worked in the past is that we haven't operated persistently. So I think this gets us past, to some degree, Andy's point, because they are promising that this is going to be, oh, like this is it. So anything other than a sharp decrease means to me that it's not working what they promised, right? For those of us that have been skeptical, if it does anything other than going down, we get to say, told you so. And that's what people are doing now with solar winds, right? Maybe a little bit unfairly of saying, see, people are, you know, play is still playing. It's not working. And I think out of those measurements, we don't have to rely on classified assessments or what's in the cyber threat intelligence companies or Microsoft or Google, right? It's fair to use what's on the front pages of the New York Times or the Washington Post, right? If we're not seeing these incredibly brazen, these reckless incidents, if we're not seeing fewer of these over time, it is entirely fair for us to say, it's doubtful that persistent engagement is not working the way that, is not having the scale of impact that was promised implicitly or explicitly. If we are seeing a decrease, well, you know, maybe it is working. So I think SolarWinds isn't helpful, but is not determinative on its own.
I was going to add, you know, yeah, I mean, SolarWinds is certainly not helpful, but I also think it highlights that a DoD cyber command strategy is not the same thing as a national strategy. There's a lot that we will learn from SolarWinds as, you know, the scale and scope of the debacle, becomes clear over time. Already I think that ought to be one lesson that that hopefully the Biden administration is drawing from that.
Yeah, I think this measures of effectiveness question is really, 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 really important. On the Slayerm Commission, we punted. I think the recommendation on the commission was to do a study to figure out how to measure effectiveness.
What a DC native. All right. And if it's okay, I hope it's okay. I shared the paper that we did on some ways of measurement in the chat. Again, we're not saying that these are the best or these are the only, but if you have to get your head around this, it's one way that's at least to start.
I mean, I think this is a really important, it's important first for like determining whether your strategy is working or not, but it's also important because of budgets. I don't want to throw a lot of money at something that in the end doesn't work. And I think, you know, our movement, for example, to task forces actually makes it even more important that we understand when we're effective, when we're not, because the US has a problem once they've built a task force of never being able to stand it down because you don't have time limits here. And so you can imagine these task forces getting larger and larger and larger. I mean, the election security was a nice task force because like, oh, election's done. Woo, define time limits. Okay, so now let's take the task force concept and let's apply it to China and great power competition. Like, okay, how that just seems to me to be like you're trying to write yourself a blank ticket to be able to get as many people, as many organizations, as much technology as you can possibly do it. And I think the reality is the next few years are going to be defense budget restrained years. They just are. You can't put this much money of stimulus into the economy and then expect to be able to continue to write blank checks. So will be incumbent on the Department of Defense and leaders within cyber to be able to articulate what is working and what is not. And here's where I think if there's anyone in the DoD listening, I really like push the DoD to differentiate measures of performance and measures of effectiveness. Because I think the vast majority of what they will rely on in cyber is measures of performance. I've stood up this many cyber missions teams. I have this many people trained. We're on keyboard this many hours. We've conducted this many operations. Even when you look at the Senate testimony about different kind of defense forwardy operations, whether it's against ISIS, election security, or Russia, we don't get a lot of impact statements. You get a lot of, we did this. Look how cool it is that we did this. But tracing that to impact is really hard. And that's not just a problem in cyberspace. We've had that problem in Afghanistan. We had that problem in Vietnam. Anytime where there's no clear end to something, especially to end to a conflict, it is very, very difficult for DoD to figure out kind of these effectiveness. So I think it's really important. Now on the North Korea question, because I want to just like tackle that one a little bit. North Korea is a super, super hard cyber problem. And we don't know a lot about what they've been doing in terms of persistent engagement or defend for when it comes to North Korea. I don't know if they're doing it, right? We've heard about things that have to do with election security. We've heard about things that have to do with ISIS. But anything you hear about North Korea is stuff coming out of like the New York Times or the Washington Post, which are, you know, conjectures or rumors about what the US may or may not have done. If we look at impact, I go back to exactly what Andy said. Is the North Korea cyber, is the North Korean cyber capability less capable than they were 4 years ago? No, they're still conducting a ton of ransomware attacks, a ton of nuisance attacks. That has not gone away. Are cyber operations affecting their ability to develop missiles? No. They're further along than they were 4 years ago. So I would say that so far, we haven't seen a lot of rewards from Defend Forward and persistent engagement for North Korea. But I would argue, and I don't know this, right? I would argue that we probably aren't doing a lot of that in North Korea, partly because North Korea already has these very strong systems of planning. They have strong alliance systems. There's a really built-in process. And persistent engagement and defend forward don't naturally fit into those processes. So I would be surprised if that has occurred at a large level. And my gut reaction in general, when we talk about solar winds and whether that's an indictment against defend forward and those kind of things, is that I think Jackie's guess is that we've actually been very restrained in implementing defend forward. I would bet you we have not done nearly as much as we could do. And so, your priors, support you, but I would argue, so when suggests we need to be more active when it comes to counter cyber operations. And then I think also looking at how do we measure intelligence successes and failures and counterintelligence successes and failures, because I think we might have more, that's more kind of direct analogy than some of these kind of the Afghanistan or Vietnam analogy. Okay, I talked for too long and now we have 5 minutes. Guys, welcome to the first series, the first kickoff in the series. I didn't tell you, but the last 5 minutes is a lightning round. So I'm going to ask you a really tough question that requires a lot of nuance, and you need to answer in one or two words.
I love it. Let's do it.
Are you ready? Okay. All right. Everybody off mute. Okay. Is deterrence dead?
No.
No. Of course okay. Not.
Defend just forward or persistent engagement?
Don't care. It doesn't matter.
Eh.
Well, you tune in next week when I have the authors of persistent engagement on. Okay. All right. Here this is a good one. The dual hat. Yes or no? And for those of you who are listening who don't know what dual hat is, the current commander of Cyber Command is also the commander of NSA. So dual hat, yes or no?
No.
Absolutely not. I'll go so far as to say it's almost un-American to have that much power in one place. And if you say, well, that's more efficient, well, so is tyranny, right? I mean, we set up our system of government to not give too much power in one place. Even like the measurement that we just talked about, right? How can you have one person grade their own homework? You got to split it.
See, and I offered Cyber Command the opportunity to contribute. They could have made their compelling argument about why to keep it. Okay. All right. Threats to critical infrastructure. Overhyped? Underhyped?
Underhyped.
Underhyped. We actually have to get Digital Pearl Harbor back in just because it hasn't happened over the last 20 years. Now that we're seeing more great power competition, it's more likely.
I'm terrified.
Oh, well, I mean, there's a lot of things to be terrified right now. So that's impressive that cyber is still up there on your list. Okay, solar winds, cyber attack or cyber espionage? Does the distinction matter?
Espionage, and I think the distinction is useful for analytic purposes, but can be overhyped in practice.
Agree, and it's absolutely right that we say this was only espionage, but it's absolutely right to say if Putin had wanted, overnight, he could have turned that into an attack, right? Imagine if the Biden administration, if one discovered, Biden administration comes in, says, we're going to clamp down on Putin. We would have been completely underestimating the strength of his hand, and he might have, if he would have chosen to do disruption. But for Putin's will, this could have been the most destructive cyber attack we've ever seen.
And also, just because it's espionage does not mean we should accept it, right? We have, every right to be thinking through what an appropriate retaliation, what an appropriate response looks like.
Okay, that was a moderator.
Proportional.
Moderator failure. I allowed far too much nuance in that conversation. All right, moving on. Okay, open, reliable, secure internet. Is it possible?
We can't get all of them. We have to choose two.
Ooh, is it worthwhile?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah. It's still the number one thing, right? It is the most transformative thing that's come out of human mind since movable type.
And it's a North Star that we can agree with vis-a-vis our allies still.
All right. What organization is more relevant and cooler? CISA or Cyber Command?
CISA. Sorry, Cyber Command.
Yep.
Love you.
Absolutely, SIPA. And if CISA, and if you want, I'll even say creating Cyber Command was a mistake. It was like creating a battleship command in 1935. If we would have actually waited a little bit longer and done an information command and thought deeply about those problems, we'd be a lot better off now.
You know what? Ooh. There are a lot of DoD institutions that I would cross off my list, and Cyber Command's not even the top 10. I got my eyes on you, like innovation commands. Yeah. All right. Cyber Armageddon. Is it going to happen or is it not?
No.
More likely than it was.
Okay.
I'll buy that.
All right. You've got the budgets. You get one line item in the budget for cyber. What is it?
What is cyber here? What do we mean? Sorry.
Do you mean we have one project that we can do, or we can have one top line number of how much we're going to spend on cyber?
Come on, stealing your thunder failure from this lightning talk.
I know. That question, like, I don't know. Like, you're making your letter to like the congressional Santas, and you got to tell them what you really want. Like, what do you really want?
I want a national baseline standard for cyber resilience that applies across the entire economy.
Oh my gosh, you're such a wonk, Andy.
If I could have, this is such a small ticket item, is we need to get a bunch of smart people together, some decision modelers, some cyber responders, and we actually walk through for each major kind of incident, who made what decision that led to what action and what information do they base it on. We have no idea how we have done response at a national or international level, or global level, I should say. It'll cost us a couple million dollars, and then we have our insurer, right? We see how we actually respond and how we can do better. It gives us, what are the actual information sharing requirements that matters when we're in an incident? We've got almost no data on that. It'll cost us $5 million and a couple cases of bourbon.
You guys are both wrong. The answer is a parking garage outside of Fort Meade.
Mm. Ooh, fair point.
Okay, so we have gone over our time. I really want to thank everyone who came, and I really, really, really want to thank my wonderful guests, Andy Grotto and Jay Healy, for this conversation. I hope you tune in for us. I think it's 2 weeks from now is our next one, and it will feature Dr. Michael Warner, who is the command historian of Cyber Command, Dr. Emily Goldman, who is a strategist at Cyber Command and one of the pens of persistent engagement. And then Admiral Ellis, one of Hoover's own and one of the first minds that was thinking about the division of cyberspace when he was leading Strategic Command. All right, thank you all for joining us today.
Thanks, guys. Thanks all for tuning in.